Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While climate change and what to do about it remains a highly polarized subject today, my guest offers a provocative new idea that, in fact, as we enter the 21st century, the globe is entering what he calls a hinge period of history, and that the impact of climate change, along with a culture shift to what he sees as a postmodernity individualism, where the answer to questions tend to be internal and subjective, offers simultaneously positive and negative consequences for the future. Jim Norwine is a geographer and professor emeritus of physics and geosciences at Texas A&M University Kingville, who's now retired to northeastern Oklahoma. He's the author and editor of a number of books and articles on climate change and geosciences, and his latest book is titled A World After Climate Change and Culture Shift, which features articles from geographers, atmospheric scientists, as well as social scientists from across the country, as well as nine countries around the globe. He joins us today to discuss his ideas with us on Studio Tulsa. Jim Norwine, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Rich.
You've edited a book called A World After Climate Change and Culture Shift. And you write in the introduction that you consider this period to be one of those hinge periods of history. I think you'd compare it to roughly 800 to 600, 400 BC, when basically religion really began to crop out. And you said what the world is dealing with is, in your technical language, two whammies. One, climate change, right, and then the culture shift to postmodernism. How are these two, are they interrelated, or are they just two big shifts at the same time that we're going to have to deal with?
Well, that's a fascinating question. They're at odds in some way, but they also probably dovetail. First of all, I like to think of the latter as shifting into postmodernity. When people hear postmodernism, they sort of associate that with, you know, architecture, shifts among artists, and so forth. Postmodernity, on the other hand, is a kind of cultural condition. It refers to the fact that we're sort of leaving modernity, just as sort of traditionality was kind of left behind gradually after the beginning of the scientific age. Similarly, that's sort of what's happening with respect to modernity. So that I'm 72, I sometimes think of myself as one of the last of the moderns, raised in the post-war years and so forth, still tremendous belief in progress. Things were getting better and better, even though we had just gone through the Holocaust and the two great wars and so forth. Now, your question was, are these working together or against one another? One way they're working against one another is that if you think about climate change, planetary warming in particular, there you're thinking about sort of a growing emphasis on limits, on constraints. A friend of mine thinks of this as a kind of slave revolt, where in the past we've thought of the environment of nature as kind of, we're going to master you.
When we pollute it, we can clean it up later.
Resources to be used.
Oil wells that cause damage, we'll come back, we'll make the lands, we'll recondition the soil and make it better than it was.
All part of that great progressive advance, as it was thought of. Now, as we get into postmodernity, in many ways it feels like just the opposite, a kind of expansion of possibilities almost limitlessly. I mean, you know, what is one of the highest values among all of us, but especially young people? Choice. Don't mess with my choices, dude. So it's a kind of horizontal valuescape now with almost limitless horizons. Here on the one hand, with the climate, you sort of have concern about, you know, constraints. We've let the genie out of the box. On the other hand, with this shift to postmodernity, it's just the opposite, a kind of infinite range of possibilities out there.
And one of the things you say demonstrates this cultural shift to postmodernity is the fact that through the age of reason, through the age of science,
yes,
we've sort of had, and climate change is one of these things. We look at the evidence.
Yep.
Planet is warming. We're seeing this planet warming. We see the connections to CO2 emissions and how they've expanded. And you said one of the ideas about this postmodernity style of thinking is the fact that our opinions and our beliefs inform our reality.
Yes.
They're coming back into this.
Yes, absolutely. I would say if any single thing defines or characterizes the postmodern condition, it's this self-referentiality to what you've just referred. I am the final arbiter. You know, sometimes when I've given talks, members of the audience, especially other scholars, will say, this is just more of the modern age. There isn't that much difference. And I'll say, look, do you think Charles Darwin or Einstein were self-referential? No, they believed in a kind of external reality. It was non-negotiable. Yes, it was different for, say, St. Francis in traditionality and Darwin in the scientific age. But nonetheless, that reality was sort of there and the final arbiter. So, for example, I mentioned growing up in the middle part of the 20th century, one example we used to have was, well, some people think the moon is made of rock and some think it's made of green cheese. Well, of course, then we sent people to the moon. They brought rocks back. And even the people, you know, who thought, well, maybe it is green cheese, after a little while, they kind of, well, okay, I guess doggone it, it is rock. But as you get into a more self-referential age, even objective evidence on its own isn't as persuasive as it once was. And I think this is a hard thing for people, especially older people like myself, you know, the last of the moderns, to get their arms around mentally. You know, again, if you go back 1,000 years, the ultimate source of authority was a sacred text like the Bible or a great sage like Aristotle. Then it became, after science, objective evidence. Those are still there, but in no way as, you know, kind of final. The locus of authority now is much more internal. This is especially true for young people. Just look, you know, ask them. Feelings, opinions, experiences. I mean, this is why you've noticed, I'm sure, that it's a much more, it's an age much more of sort of feelings. We worry much more about sort of hurting somebody else's feelings with words. In my day, when I was growing up as a kid, it was sticks and stones can break my bones. Who cares about words? We care a lot about words now.
Well, in person-to-person conversation, now when you talk about the internet, it's a completely different thing where you have the anonymity.
Yes.
I'd like to move on, if we could, to talking about how does this postmodernity affect our ability to come up with effective remediations, if you will, if we can, to climate change. And I mean, this is another big debate within itself. You have people who believe that climate change is not occurring. They believe it's occurring, but it's not man-made. Then you have those that believe that it's occurring and man-made, but there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, you have this whole spectrum of opinion going from what do we do about climate change?
Well, it's a complicated subject, but you could almost boil it down to maybe two options, really, finally. Three, perhaps, if you throw geoengineering in as a sort of last-ditch possibility. On the one hand, you can try to build a kind of consensus. Be very transparent. Be as, you know, as absolutely forthright as you can be. I'm speaking now of sort of scholars like myself, advocates, you know, kind of elite educated types, and sort of bring more and more people on board. Sort of a classic kind of democratic consensus sort of thing. Or you can go a kind of almost soft totalitarian route where it's more like, say, requiring seatbelts. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of tell everybody, this is so important, you're going to have to do it from now on. You take away a little bit of liberty. Now, I would much prefer the former. I certainly agree that there are cases like seatbelts, and I would think, you know, helmets and so forth, where that's the only way to go, probably. It's too dangerous in the short run to, you know, work towards some consensus. But that kind of approach has its own longer-term dangers. And I guess I argue in the book to some degree we're seeing some of that play out. I don't think that there's been as much trust in ordinary people as there could have been. And so I think we elites have been rather consistently disingenuous. We've made the case that, for example, shifting, transforming to a post-fossil fuel world won't be that tough. That's just nonsense, absolute nonsense. When you look at the amount of, you know, energy we generate worldwide now, all the studies show that it's going to take a long time to replace that with alternatives. And I say in the book somewhere that I've even heard it said at climate conferences after a few beers that we have to be disingenuous because we can't sort of trust ordinary people to do the right thing. you know, pay more for energy and so forth, if we're that forthcoming. I really reject that.
I think that's one of the interesting things you've brought up in the book is the fact that the proponents of dealing with climate change have not really, they've been afraid to give us a sense of how difficult this task will be, believing, and perhaps rightly so,
yes,
that if we're told it's that tough, people will be less inclined to listen. But I think there is something disingenuous about saying, well, if you just recycle, you know, your garbage, if you switch to that car that gets a few more miles per gallon, or maybe is even yes. even a hybrid fuel
right.
or something like that, that this is going to solve, or it's going to really make a dent in CO2 emissions over the long term.
Right.
When you're talking about a worldwide population, you know, this is just U.S. things
yeah.
as opposed to China, India, Asia in particular, Africa as it emerges. We're looking at, these are going to be very, very difficult decisions that countries and
yes.
multi-nation organizations are going to have to put together. What should climate scientists be saying about the changes necessary to at least begin to arrest the growth of CO2 emissions?
Well, I guess when it comes to saying what they should say, there's one thing that I've suggested first and foremost, and that's I'm a strong supporter of Dr. James Hansen's idea of what he calls fee and dividend, and we can talk about that if you like. I almost think, though, that's secondary to, you know, what they should do. You know, if you think about when I was growing up, 50s, 60s, the civil rights movement, one of the main things that was just fantastically persuasive was sacrifice. Those folks exhibited personal sacrifice.
Talking about the home front during World War II and things like that, or during the Great Depression.
Well, and then, yes, I wasn't thinking of those, but those are great examples. But then in the civil rights movement, think of those folks, you know, sweating, marching on the bridges, getting bitten by dogs, going to jail, and sort of accepting it as, okay, this is part of the price that I'm supposed to pay to exemplify to ordinary people, this is the right thing. Where's the comparable sacrifice now on the part of elites? I mean, I'm a big fan of Al Gore's movie and book, but I mean, come on, personal sacrifice? You know, a huge house, more energy consumption than the rest of his little county.
Let's fly to Copenhagen for a climate change conference.
Fly there. In that one flight, you've probably, you know, had as big an energy footprint as some redneck, you know, with his pickup for a year. People notice these things, especially now, to come back to culture shift, in this age of, I'm sure you've noticed this, if you want to persuade somebody in a self-referential age, you have to sort of rub your experience up against theirs, kind of almost a Velcro way. I mean, preaching and lecturing the way I did for 50 years has always been, moderately effective. I think it's less effective now than ever. You have to show. You have to demonstrate.
It's really interesting because when you look at like this generation's way of getting involved with
yes.
the projects they care about, it doesn't usually mean let's start a big organization. It's a non-hierarchical organization.
Yeah.
So it's basically a person going saying, I'm going to go start an orphanage, or I'm going to find a way to adoption system in Africa to help orphans there. You know, and I had so many guests on here in the last 5 or 6 years where it's, I'm going to just do this. They find backers that will basically help support them. But they go out and do it on a grassroots level where they're actually living a life as opposed to starting a organization and a sort of, you know, the typical UNICEF sort of model where it's a non-governmental organizations. There are all these grassroots organizations coming up where it's basically no hierarchy, just go out and do it.
Yeah, there's something really deep there, and you see that on campuses. I'm sure here at TU you have this big emphasis now on service learning. It can be imposed a little bit too much, I worry about that, but still I think it does resonate with the young. You know, they're living in an age where they're not too certain about any certainty, even their own. And, you know, that's scary in one way, but it also makes them more open to others. It makes them very skeptical about, talking the talk. They believe in walking the walk. They really do.
My guest today is Jim Norwine, a professor emeritus of physics and geosciences at Texas A&M University, Kingsville. He is the editor of A World After Climate Change and Culture Shift, which features a number of scholars' essays. And it's, I have to admit, Jim, it is a really wide range of opinion getting into this idea of postmodernity, culture shift, as well as climate change. And some are very detailed on climate change. A really interesting essay from, I guess, a group of researchers in Vietnam that are sort of affecting how climate change is going to, what it's going to do to the Mekong Delta, basically showing what the effect of sea level rise and all the effects of climate change are going to be on their particular part of the world. Yes. Others are very fanciful, almost philosophical in its approach, but he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you were talking about, again, this idea that elites are not sort of effectively walking the walk when it comes to talking about climate change. And one of the things you've written about is still this sort of belief in cap and trade, which I think you referred to Dr. Jim Hansen as saying is basically this is a half-assed approach to combating climate change. He talks about a fee and dividend system. Yes. Tell us what a fee and dividend system is.
Okay. Incidentally, that quote of Jim's was, you know, when he was invited to California by Governor Brown, who was so proud of their new cap and dividend system, and Hansen
cap
got
and
up.
Trade, yeah.
Yeah, cap and trade, I'm sorry. And Hansen went, you know, said right there, this is half-assed. We've seen elsewhere that cap and trade doesn't do a good job of reducing emissions. And at the same time, it tends to lead, has the potential to lead to sort of more social inequity, greater difference between the haves and have-nots. His pitch, anybody can go online and just search James Hansen or fee and dividend to get the details. What he says is, okay, let's increase the cost of energy and thereby reduce, have the effect of reducing emissions by tacking on a fee. I mean, most people might think of it as a tax. The difference is that every individual or family, the records will be kept of how much that fee totes up to by the end of the year, and they'll get that rebated directly to them. None of that money will go to the government, as it is in California right now. I mean, this is why bureaucrats love cap and trade, because billions of dollars come pouring in. A lot of it from, you know, big industries, you know, sort of buying...
the ability not to have to change their way of doing business.
Yes, right. Yeah, sort of paying the penalty, which is why you don't wind up reducing emissions much. Hansen demonstrates, I think, pretty robustly and persuasively that his fee and dividend approach over time will have the effect of people cutting back. They'll see, you know, that it's in their best interest to cool a little bit less in the summer, do more insulating, drive a little bit less.
You only halfway explained it. You pay a fee each month for your energy usage?
All the energy.
All the energy.
So it's going to be...
So it's going to be your gas.
Gas, electricity.
Electricity.
The whole enchilada.
Natural gas. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, what happens at the end of the year? You said it comes back to the individuals.
You get all of that back. So it's he thinks of it as a dividend. And you might say, well... Okay, couldn't they just blow that money on another gas guzzler or something? In theory, but in practice, what happens is it's very experiential. So people notice that, first of all, they're going to get the money back that they paid. So it doesn't feel as oppressive as a tax, where the money's just going into government coffers and, you know, maybe it benefits you, maybe it doesn't. The other thing is that his studies have shown that this system most favors the people on the lower end of the economic spectrum, the working class. Cap and trade is relatively easy for affluent, comfy, cozy people like us to adapt to. Okay, energy goes up so much. We have one fewer vacations in Cabo. You know, we cuss and grumble, but we adjust. But if you're on the lower end, like my wife Lottie and I lived for 40 years in South Texas. The summer there goes to November, sometimes early December. Air conditioning, you know, is an essential now. Now, even as it is, air conditioning in an average house is $350 a month. And that can actually be worse than that if you have like a single-wide trailer that's not insulated. Now imagine doubling that. You know, it becomes prohibitive for ordinary people, mm-hmm. you know, under cap and trade. So I think the first thing I would recommend is in terms of what you asked earlier, what should elites sort of say, is get behind that approach.
Now, let me ask about how it actually works. So you get the dividend back from this essentially a fee or tax you've been paying throughout the year.
Right.
Is there any requirement to spend it on sort of reducing your carbon footprint? You can use it however
no.
you want.
No.
But the idea is that people will see, wow, I was spending so much
yeah.
a month, my
yeah.
air conditioning bill. Maybe I need to use this to buy a more efficient air conditioner.
Absolutely.
More insulation.
Right.
I see how much I spend on fueling my car. Maybe I trade that in and get a more fuel-efficient car.
Yeah. You know, if you're of a cynical turn of mind, it sounds a little naive.
It does.
You know? How do I say this? Note the contrast to this other approach I mentioned earlier, where you go this kind of soft totalitarian route. You don't really think ordinary people are that sharp. Well, you know, we can't be too honest. We're going to have to impose this on them. That's the only way this is ever going to work. I think Hansen and I have more faith in ordinary people if you're very transparent with them. The trick is, where are we going? You asked me earlier, what are the options? I think those are the two. You're either transparent and you kind of have this almost naive faith that, you know, people will get with the program if they see that you're being honest and candid, or you better go the cynical route.
And that honesty and candor also means that we really have to talk about how difficult it is to wean ourselves from fossil fuels, or at least to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels, because I know I just gather myself that it's going to be incredibly difficult to totally wean ourselves. Too much of our society is, everything from the things we're wearing to the products we use in a day and base have petroleum bases, a lot of times in them, plastics, all sorts of things. It'd be incredibly difficult. But if we can reduce the amount of fossil fuels we're using, I suppose that can help us at least reduce CO2 emissions over the long term.
Well, and be sort of exemplary with respect to, as you said earlier, the rest of the world. I mean, already we're falling. You know, China is the biggest CO2 emitter, and every year the gap between them and us, and if you add up China and India and Brazil and the Indonesia and so forth, the lion's share now of emissions are coming from them. And so I think all the better that we're sort of good examples. I think one key thing, though, whatever you do, I mean, for me, especially as a theist, a Christian, is to have kind of the least of these foremost in our mind, that you know, whatever we do, we need to ease the burden on the people on the lowest end of the spectrum as much as possible. And, you know, in a way, sort of like Obamacare is, where you subsidize those folks. So as energy costs go up, you know, it doesn't take 50% of their income or something like that. Whereas for those of us, you know, you make it basically progressive. I think that sells even to conservatives, as long as you're forthright. Speaking as a sort of right of center guy, you know, I'm happy about Obamacare, but I don't think it was sold as transparently as it could have been. And I think that's part of the reaction.
My guest today is Jim Norwine, Professor Emeritus of Physics and Geosciences at Texas A&M University, Kingsville. He's retired to the northeastern Oklahoma, and he's the editor of A World After Climate Change and Culture Shift, featuring a number of scholars weighing in on climate change issues as well as the culture shift to postmodernity. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you mentioned one other thing. You said the third possible way to deal with climate change is geoengineering.
Geoengineering.
Now, that sounds like, yeah. sounds somewhat fantastic or fantastical, but are there viable geoengineering solutions out there, or at least in theory?
It's one of those things that we don't like to think about because, for several reasons. First of all, you know, it might be an excuse not to be serious about cutting back emissions. That if we have this kind of, you know, last ditch.
Technology will save us.
Technology will save us, yeah. Right there with progress as the hallmark of the modern age. And also there's probably a kind of a sense within many of us that, technology got us into this fix. Do we really want to go that road? But when you catch me, you know, in the right mood, I sometimes think if we don't get our act together, it may come to that. Probably the number one way would be to add aerosols high in the atmosphere. Aerosols are little bitty particles or droplets that add to the albedo or reflection of incoming sunlight. So if you put a bunch of those rascals way up high, yeah, you could reflect more incoming sunlight.
It's probably a tricky equation to make sure you don't have a winter all year.
Well, plus all kinds of problems.
A good volcano can do that too.
For a year or two, yeah, like 1991, Pinatubo. So, those solutions are out there. It's interesting because if things get really bad, I could see a situation where a nation or even a rich individual could decide to try something like that. You know, it sounds hard to believe now, but things could get pretty scary if we have, you know, a run of very hot, dry years. We're kind of right on the cusp in eastern Oklahoma as to what the models show. Will we get wetter or drier? And it's very hard to say which way we'll go. We're right on the edge.
I'm guessing from what I can see of what our weather's like. You can't make climate predictions from weather, but it seems like we'll be both drier, warmer, and wetter.
More variable, there's no doubt about it. It's just that at our latitude, well, think about these last couple of months. We've had this storm track coming through. Lottie and I got almost 20 inches in 1 month on Ulaga Lake. You know, what happens as it gets warmer is that the subtropical high-pressure dry belt gets kind of goosed poleward. We've seen this in every warm period. The hot air rises over the equator, sinks at about 30 degrees north, and that gives you the deserts, and then flows back at the surface of the equator. In warm periods, that so-called Hadley cell expands poleward, so it sort of shifts the dry subtropics more into the middle latitudes. Now, so that in theory, as it gets warmer, the southern U.S. gets drier, the northern U.S. gets wetter. We're right on the cusp. So our kids will live to see how that plays out. Right now, you can't say.
Well, it's an interesting book, and you had some really interesting opinions about the future of how we deal with climate change. Jim Norwine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Pleasure.
Jim Norwine is a professor emeritus of physics and geosciences at Texas A&M University, Kingville. His latest book, of which he is the editor, is titled A World After Climate Change and Culture Shift. It's published by Springer. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.